Welcome to Curiosity Labs, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of cutting-edge research. I'm Tom.
And I'm Jen. On today's episode, we're diving into a fascinating study that explores how people perceive price hikes during crisis situations like the COVID-19 pandemic.
The paper we'll be discussing is titled Price Gouging or Market Forces: Fairness Perceptions of Price Hikes in the Pandemic by Avichai Sneer, Daniel Levy, Dudy Levy, and Haipeng Alan Chen.
As we all experienced during the early days of the pandemic, many essential goods like toiletries, cleaning supplies, and medical equipment became scarce, leading to sharp price increases. But were these price hikes justified by market forces, or did they cross the line into unethical price gouging?
Exactly. This research explores how consumers perceive such price increases and what factors influence whether they view them as fair or unfair. The authors conducted surveys in the U.S. and Israel to gauge people's reactions to real-world examples of pandemic price hikes.
One of the key findings is that people are more accepting of price increases driven by cost shocks, like disruptions in the supply chain, than those driven purely by demand spikes. This aligns with the principle of dual entitlement from behavioral economics.
Let's start by unpacking that principle, as it's central to understanding the research. The basic idea is that both consumers and firms have certain entitlements in a market transaction. Consumers feel entitled to the terms of a reference transaction, like the pre-pandemic prices they were accustomed to paying.
Right. And businesses feel entitled to their reference profit levels. So if a firm raises prices solely to capitalize on increased demand and boost profits, consumers see that as a violation of their entitlement and perceive it as unfair price gouging.
However, if the price increase is driven by factors outside the firm's control, like higher costs of production or supply chain disruptions, consumers are more likely to view it as a justified response to maintain the firm's reference profit. It's all about the perceived motive behind the price hike.
Exactly. The researchers put this principle to the test by asking survey respondents about various real-world examples of goods whose prices spiked during the pandemic, like hand sanitizer, toilet paper, and surgical masks.
For each good, they provided two scenarios, one where the price increase was attributed to a demand shock, and one where it was due to a supply or cost shock. Respondents then rated how acceptable or unacceptable they found each price hike.
And the results lined up perfectly with the dual entitlement principle. Price increases blamed on demand spikes were seen as much less fair than those attributed to disruptions in supply or increased costs.
It's a really elegant demonstration of how these psychological entitlement principles shape our perceptions of fairness, even in the face of basic economic forces like supply and demand.
Absolutely. But the researchers didn't stop there. They also found some fascinating differences in how the two populations, Americans and Israelis, perceived the same price hikes. Can you elaborate on that, Tom?
Sure, Jen. While both groups showed the same general pattern of being more accepting of cost-driven than demand-driven price hikes, the Israeli respondents consistently rated all the price increases as less acceptable compared to the Americans.
That's such an intriguing cultural difference. Any thoughts on what might be driving that?
Well, the authors speculate that it could be related to the different economic environments and histories of the two countries. Israel has experienced periods of very high inflation, so there may be a stronger cultural aversion to dramatic price fluctuations.
That makes a lot of sense. It's a great reminder that our perceptions of economic fairness are shaped not just by rational principles, but also by the social and historical context we're embedded in.
Absolutely. And we shouldn't overlook the fact that there were also significant differences in how acceptable the two populations found price hikes for different types of goods like food versus personal care products.
You're right, Tom. That's another fascinating layer to this research. Can you give us some examples of those product-specific differences?
Sure. For instance, both the American and Israeli respondents found price hikes for food items like pasta and flour to be much less acceptable than for things like soap or toilet paper, even when the underlying reasons were the same.
I can certainly relate to that. When it comes to basic food staples, I think we have an even stronger sense of entitlement to stable, affordable prices. Increases in those areas really rub against our fairness intuitions.
Precisely. It speaks to the psychological importance we place on different types of goods based on how essential they are. Price fluctuations become much harder to swallow when they impact our access to fundamental needs like food.
Such a great point. This research is packed with so many insights about the complex psychological forces that shape our economic behavior and perceptions of fairness. Perhaps we could take a step back and discuss some of the broader implications.
Definitely. I think one of the key takeaways is how critical it is for businesses to be attuned to consumer fairness perceptions, especially during crises or periods of instability. Blindly following market principles without considering the psychological factors at play could seriously damage consumer trust and brand reputation.
Absolutely. And on a societal level, this research highlights the tension between market efficiency and protecting consumer welfare during shocks or shortages. There's no easy answer, but policymakers need to carefully weigh both economic realities and psychological realities.
Well said, Jen. Ultimately, this study is a powerful reminder that we're not just rational economic actors, but psychologically complex beings deeply influenced by entrenched notions of fairness and justice. Ignoring those human elements is a recipe for conflict and suboptimal outcomes.
You summed it up perfectly, Tom. Whether we're businesses, policymakers, or simply consumers trying to make sense of a crisis, we can't lose sight of the powerful role our fairness perceptions play in shaping economic realities.
Those are such insightful reflections on this fascinating research. Before we wrap up, let's quickly recap the key takeaways from the price gouging or market forces study.
First and foremost, it provides compelling evidence for the principle of dual entitlement and how it shapes our judgments of price fairness, especially during disruptive events like the COVID-19 pandemic.
Secondly, it reveals striking cultural differences in how populations perceive price hikes, likely stemming from differing economic histories and social contexts.
And finally, it highlights the nuanced role that product type and essentialness play in our fairness assessments, with price increases for basic needs like food being met with much greater consumer resistance.
Absolutely. This multifaceted research leaves us with a much richer understanding of the complex psychological forces underlying our economic decision-making and perceptions.
It's a great example of how scientific inquiry can illuminate the human elements that are so often overlooked in purely rational economic models.
Well said, Jen. That's a wrap on another insightful episode exploring the fascinating intersection of economics, psychology, and human behavior.
Join us next time as we continue unpacking cutting-edge research that deepens our understanding of the world around us. Until then, keep exploring.
This has been Curiosity Labs. Thanks for listening. Here's a funny, weird, and concise commercial for a fictional company inspired by the research paper Price Gouging or Market Forces. Fairness perceptions of price hikes in the pandemic. Are you tired of being price gouged during emergencies? Introducing Entecor, the revolutionary new fairness enforcement service. At Entecor, our psychologists and economists work together to ensure businesses respect the sacred principle of dual entitlement. Cuts to a scene of a surly CEO begrudgingly handing money back to a happy customer. Here's your pandemic price gouging refund. Thanks, Entecor. Whether it's toilet paper, hand sanitizer, or just some dang pasta, our fairness AI monitors real-time price hikes and demand shocks. If a company tries to increase profits by violating your consumer entitlements, we slam them with social shame. Cuts to Entecor employees furiously tweeting from cubicles. So don't get gouged again. Keep those profiteering businesses entitled and those prices stable with Entecor, protecting your right to affordable essentials no matter how irrational you consumers may be. Tagline appears. Entecor forcing fairness, pandemic or not. Here is a detailed podcast episode discussing the research paper Carbon Economics of Different Agricultural Practices for Farming Soil. Welcome to Discover, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of cutting-edge research. I'm Tom.
And I'm Jen. On today's episode, we're diving into the world of carbon sequestration and exploring how different farming practices can impact the amount of carbon stored in agricultural soils.
The paper we'll be discussing is titled Carbon Economics of Different Agricultural Practices for Farming Soil by a team of researchers from Tamil Nadu Agricultural University in India.
This study provides a comprehensive review of various agricultural techniques and their effects on soil organic carbon levels. The authors make a compelling case that sustainable farming methods like cover cropping, conservation tillage, and agroforestry could be key tools in mitigating climate change.
Right off the bat, the introduction lays out the high stakes involved. Since the Industrial Revolution, human activity has caused atmospheric carbon levels to spike by a staggering 31%, contributing to global warming.
And a big part of that increase is due to the depletion of soil organic carbon from intensive agricultural practices. We've lost an estimated 78 petagrams of carbon from soils globally, which is just mind-boggling.
It really puts into perspective how crucial it is that we find ways to sequester more carbon in the soil. As the authors point out, agricultural lands could potentially store up to 1.1 to 2.2 petagrams of carbon over the next 50 years just through improved crop production methods.
Absolutely. And beyond just climate benefits, increasing soil organic carbon is vital for maintaining soil health and fertility too. The organic matter acts like a sponge, improving water retention and preventing erosion, while also providing key nutrients to crops.
So let's dig into the specific agricultural practices highlighted in the paper that can boost soil carbon levels. First up is conservation tillage, which involves minimizing soil disturbance and leaving crop residues on the field.
That's right. Conventional tillage, with all that plowing and tilling, exposes soil to air, which accelerates the breakdown of organic matter and releases stored carbon into the atmosphere as CO2.
But conservation tillage is like a softer touch. By not churning up the soil and leaving those plant residues as a protective blanket, it slows down that carbon loss while also improving soil structure over time.
The numbers are pretty impressive. Studies cited in the paper estimate that widespread adoption of conservation tillage practices in the US alone could sequester between 24 to 40 million tons of atmospheric carbon annually in soils.
Wow, that's a significant amount. And it helps illustrate the massive potential for this solution on a global scale. The researchers calculate that converting all croplands to conservation tillage systems could absorb 25 petagrams of carbon over 50 years.
Exactly. It's an elegant way to turn depleted agricultural soils back into productive carbon sinks. The organic matter and crop residues get reincorporated into the soil over time instead of being released as emissions.
Another practice examined in the paper is using cover crops between cash crop growing seasons. These are crops like legumes, grasses, or grains grown solely to replenish the soil.
Cover crops are amazing for so many reasons. Their roots help break up compacted soil, while their residues replenish organic matter as they decompose. That constant plant growth and carbon input from cover crops is like giving a vitamin boost to the soil microbial life too.
It's a stark contrast to leaving fields bare during off-seasons, which provides no new organic inputs while exposing soil to potential erosion losses. The numbers really demonstrate the carbon storage advantage of cover cropping.
Yes, the meta-analysis in the paper found that incorporating cover crops into rotations increased soil organic carbon levels by about 0.32 metric tons per hectare per year at around 22 centimeters depth. And modeling showed that could accumulate to almost 70 metric tons per hectare after 155 years of continuous cover cropping.
Those are some incredible long-term payoffs. I was also fascinated by the section on agroforestry systems where crops are grown amongst trees. The symbiotic relationships between the different plants seems to really enhance carbon sequestration.
Definitely. Having that combined root network from trees and crops puts more organic matter into the ground. Plus, the canopy cover and leaf litter continuously replenishes the soil carbon stocks from above too.
It makes me wish more farms integrated components of agroforestry into their design. The authors argue these systems have the highest carbon storage potential of any agricultural approach.
For sure. And we haven't even touched on the other practices highlighted, like organic amendments, mulching, intercropping, and well-designed crop rotations, all tools that can push soils towards become carbon sinks instead of sources over time.
You're absolutely right, Jen. This paper opened my eyes to just how pivotal our farming practices are when it comes to the carbon cycle and climate change, whether it's reduced tillage, cover cropping, agroforestry, or other sustainable methods. There's so much potential to leverage agricultural soils as a storage solution.
I couldn't agree more, Tom. By prioritizing techniques that build up soil organic carbon levels, we can boost crop productivity while simultaneously pulling greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere and into the ground. A real win-win scenario.
It's certainly an exciting frontier in climate-smart agriculture that promises huge environmental and economic benefits. I can't wait to see more research, incentives, and adoption around these types of carbon farming practices.
Absolutely. We'd be remiss not to thank the authors for their excellent work synthesizing this timely and important topic for us today.
You're right, Jen. A big thanks to the researchers, Anbalagan Krishnaveni, Shuganthi Pazanivel Kushika, Sela Paruma Pazanivelan, and the whole team for their illuminating dive into the carbon economics of agricultural soils.
For all our listeners out there, we encourage you to check out the full paper so you can dig even deeper into this critical issue at the intersection of climate science and sustainable food production.
That's it for this episode of Discover. Many thanks to our audience for joining us on this journey into the world of carbon farming practices. We'll be back soon with a new research topic, but until then,
stay curious.
Here's a funny, weird commercial for a fictional company inspired by the research paper on carbon farming practices. Quirky jingle plays. Announcer. Are you tired of feeling guilty about your carbon footprint? Introducing Soil Squirrels, the world's first carbon capture service powered by cuddly rodents. Shows squirrels scurrying around burying nuts in the ground. No more doomy gloom when it comes to greenhouse gas emissions. Thanks to our team of highly trained squirrels, we're turning agricultural soils into carbon sinks one nut at a time. Cut to a farmer spreading squirrel food pellets across a field. Thanks to Soil Squirrels, I'm sequestering over 10 metric tons of CO2 per acre this year just by switching to no-till. Squirrel wearing a tiny hard hat and doing calculations on an abacus. That's the power of our patented Squirrelock carbon capture technology. As the squirrels bury nuts and seed caches, they're steadily building up organic matter to lock carbon safely underground for centuries. Dramatic close-up of a squirrel's cheeky grin and wiggling nose. So ditch the expensive carbon offsets and rewilding schemes. Go nuts with Soil Squirrels for the furriest, most cost-effective way to achieve negative emissions. Camera pans across idyllic farm with squirrels cheerfully scampering everywhere. Farmer's kid, I love our friendly little carbon captors. Announcer. Soil Squirrels, making the world a butter place, one nutty step at a time. Silly squirrel sound effects and jogging jingle. Visit soilsquirrels.com to sign up for our acorn delivery service today. Your soil will go nuts for it. Welcome to the Research Rewind, where we dive deep into cutting-edge scientific discoveries and bring them to life through captivating storytelling. I'm Tom.
And I'm Jen. Today, we'll be discussing a fascinating paper titled Study of the Impact of the Big Data Era on Accounting and Auditing by researchers from institutions like EY, BDO USA, Westcliff University, and the Hong Kong Polytechnic University.
This paper explores the profound effects of the big data revolution on the accounting and auditing professions. Brace yourselves, because we're about to embark on a journey through a world of massive data sets, advanced analytics, and the challenges of navigating this data-driven landscape.
That's right, Tom. The rise of big data has reshaped the way we collect, analyze, and utilize information, revolutionizing traditional approaches to financial analysis, risk assessment, and compliance monitoring. This paper offers a comprehensive analysis of both the opportunities and challenges that come with this transformation.
Let's start by setting the stage for our listeners. Imagine a world where data is being generated at an unprecedented rate from sources like social media, IoT devices, and transactional records. this deluge of information has rendered traditional methods of financial reporting and auditing inadequate, struggling to keep up with the sheer volume, velocity, and variety of data.
Exactly. In this environment, accounting and auditing professionals are faced with the daunting task of extracting meaningful insights while ensuring data integrity and reliability. But fear not, for the emergence of artificial intelligence and machine learning algorithms offers a glimmer of hope.
It's like having a team of super intelligent assistants at your disposal, capable of automating routine tasks, enhancing analytical capabilities, and detecting anomalies with astonishing accuracy and efficiency. Imagine being able to analyze every single transaction, every contract, every piece of financial data, without having to rely on sampling or manual review.
The potential benefits are truly staggering. By harnessing the power of big data analytics, auditors can conduct comprehensive, all-data audits, uncovering risks and issues that might have gone undetected using traditional sampling methods. And accountants can gain real-time insights into a company's financial health, enabling them to provide more timely and informed advice to stakeholders.
But as with any revolutionary technology, the big data era also presents formidable challenges. Data privacy and security concerns loom large as sensitive financial information becomes increasingly vulnerable to breaches and unauthorized access. Regulatory compliance is another hurdle, with laws like GDPR and CCPA adding layers of complexity to the handling and processing of data.
Not to mention the challenges of integrating vast and diverse datasets from multiple sources. It's like trying to solve a massive jigsaw puzzle with pieces that don't quite fit together. And let's not forget the human factor. Accounting and auditing professionals must continuously upskill and adapt to stay relevant in this rapidly evolving landscape.
It's a daunting task, but the researchers offer strategic countermeasures to navigate this transformative era effectively. From leveraging advanced analytics tools and cloud computing platforms to investing in cybersecurity measures and talent development initiatives, organizations can enhance their capacity to harness the potential of big data while mitigating associated risks.
And collaboration is key. The paper emphasizes the importance of stakeholders, regulators, industry associations, academia, working together to foster innovation, knowledge sharing, and industry-wide standards. By embracing the opportunities afforded by big data while addressing its inherent challenges, accounting and auditing professionals can position themselves as trusted advisors, equipped to provide actionable insights and strategic guidance in an increasingly data-driven world.
It's an exciting time, no doubt, but let's reflect on some personal thoughts and opinions. Jen, what did you find most intriguing about this research?
For me, it was the potential of big data analytics to revolutionize the audit process. The idea of conducting comprehensive, all-data audits rather than relying on sampling is truly game-changing. It could significantly enhance the accuracy and reliability of audit findings, ultimately improving transparency and trust in financial reporting.
I completely agree. And I'm fascinated by the role of artificial intelligence and machine learning in automating routine tasks and enhancing analytical capabilities. Imagine freeing up auditors and accountants to focus on more complex strategic work while leaving the tedious tasks to intelligent algorithms. It's like having a tireless army of assistants working around the clock.
That said, I do have some concerns about the potential for bias and errors in these algorithms. As powerful as they are, they're still designed and trained by humans who may unconsciously introduce biases or make mistakes. It's crucial that we maintain a healthy dose of professional skepticism and human oversight, even as we embrace these new technologies.
Excellent point, Jen. And let's not forget the ethical considerations surrounding data privacy and security. As we collect and analyze ever-increasing amounts of sensitive financial data, we must prioritize robust safeguards and adhere to strict ethical standards to maintain public trust.
Absolutely. But overall, I'm incredibly excited about the potential of big data to drive innovation and efficiency in the accounting and auditing professions. It's a transformative era, and those who embrace it strategically will undoubtedly have a competitive edge.
In conclusion, the big data era presents both immense opportunities and significant challenges for accounting and auditing. By leveraging advanced analytics tools, fostering collaboration, and prioritizing data security and talent development, professionals can navigate this landscape effectively and provide invaluable insights in an increasingly data-driven world.
Thank you for joining us on this thought-provoking exploration of the impact of big data on accounting and auditing. Until next time, keep questioning, keep learning, and keep pushing the boundaries of discovery.
Here is a funny, weird, and concise commercial for a fictional company that was created as a result of the research findings in the paper. Study of the impact of the big data era on accounting and auditing. Electronic beats and synthesizer sounds. Announcer. Are you tired of boring old accounting? Sick of audits that only scratch the surface? Well, say hello to AlgoCounting, the revolutionary accounting firm of the future. At AlgoCounting, we don't just crunch numbers. No, we devour data! Thanks to our proprietary hyperheuristic AI engine, we can analyze every last byte of your financial records in exabyte-level detail. But won't that take forever? Of course not, silly human. Our quantum auditing cube can scrutinize a trillion transactions in just 14 nanoseconds. Power up sound effects. No stone is left unturned, no penny unaccounted for. We'll sniff out fraud, inefficiencies, and reasonless restatements before they can say material weakness. Customer, what about data privacy? Relax. Our CyptoKeeper blockchain ensures only authorized nodes can access the hashed financial ohms. It's unhackable. Well, sort of. So bid farewell to outdated sampling and sampling risk. With AlgoCounting's Lightspeed Analytics, you'll get real-time insights beamed directly into your cybervisor. Laser sounds. The big data future is here. Embrace the singularity of perfect books. AlgoCounting, scatting techno. We're the lucky crypto few who know why. Hipster dance break. Welcome to Illuminating Research, the podcast that dives deep into cutting-edge scientific discoveries with intrigue and depth. I'm Tom.
And I'm Jen. Today we'll be discussing a fascinating paper titled Small Price Changes, Sales Volume, and Menu Cost by Doran Syag, Avichai Sneer, and Daniel Levy.
This empirical study sheds light on a puzzling phenomenon in pricing behavior, the existence of small price changes, which seems to contradict the predictions of the standard menu cost model.
That's right, Tom. The menu cost model suggests that firms should make infrequent but relatively large price changes because making frequent small adjustments is less economical due to the fixed costs associated with changing prices.
However, the researchers found that small price changes are quite common in their data set, accounting for 20% to 44% of observed price changes across various product categories.
And their key finding is that small price changes are significantly more likely for products with high sales volumes. This observation seems to have been overlooked by existing literature, despite its intuitive appeal.
Exactly, Jen. Let's dive into the details of this paper and explore how the researchers arrived at this fascinating conclusion.
The study utilizes a massive retail scanner price dataset from Dominick's, a large U.S. food chain, containing over 98 million weekly observations spanning 8 years and covering 13,504 products across 29 categories.
This dataset is particularly well-suited for their analysis because it includes not only retail prices, but also crucial information on the number of units sold and the revenue generated for each product.
To begin their investigation, the researchers defined a small price change as one that is 10 cents or less in absolute terms, rather than relative to the product's price.
This definition makes sense because their hypothesis suggests that a price change of a given size is profitable if the change in cents, multiplied by the sales volume, exceeds the menu cost, regardless of the product's price.
Exactly. And they found that across all product categories, 26.6% of price changes were small, with an average sales volume of 10 units per week.
But when they divided the products into deciles based on sales volume, a striking pattern emerged.
Yes, the percentage of small price changes in the highest sales volume decile was a staggering 33.36%, which is 2.4 times higher than the lowest sales volume decile at 13.89%.
To formally test this correlation, the researchers ran a series of fixed effect regressions, controlling for various factors such as month, year, store, and product fixed effects, as well as average price levels, wholesale price changes, and sale prices.
And the results were consistent across all specifications. There was a positive and statistically significant correlation between the likelihood of a small price change and the average sales volume.
For instance, in one specification, a 1% increase in sales volume was associated with a 1.7 percentage point increase in the likelihood of a small price change.
But the researchers didn't stop there. They also conducted category-level analyses to ensure that the correlation wasn't driven by unobserved attributes of certain product categories.
Right, and the results were compelling. In 28 out of 29 product categories, there was a positive and statistically significant correlation between small price changes and sales volumes, even after controlling for various factors.
The researchers went even further by analyzing the correlation at the individual product level within each category.
Yes, and the results were striking. For most products, there was a positive and statistically significant correlation between sales volume and the share of small price changes across different stores.
This finding is particularly powerful because it rules out the possibility that the observed correlation is driven by unobserved product attributes, since each regression focused on a single product.
Absolutely. The researchers also conducted numerous robustness checks, such as using alternative definitions of small price changes, addressing potential measurement errors, and controlling for factors like price synchronization, producer size, and competition levels.
And throughout these analyses, the positive correlation between small price changes and sales volumes remained robust, suggesting that this finding is not an artifact of the specific assumptions or data cleaning methods used.
Indeed, the researchers provide a compelling theoretical motivation for their findings by extending Barrow's menu cost model derive a relationship between the width of the optimal SS pricing band and the sales volume.
That's right. Their model predicts an inverse relationship between the level of output or sales volume and the width of the optimal SS band, implying that high sales volume products will exhibit more frequent but smaller price changes.
And this prediction aligns perfectly with their empirical findings, lending further credence to their results and contributing to our understanding of pricing behavior in the presence of menu costs.
Absolutely. This paper not only uncovers a fascinating empirical regularity, but also provides a solid theoretical foundation to explain the observed phenomenon. Reflections.
This paper presents such a compelling and intuitive explanation for the prevalence of small price changes, which has long been considered a puzzle in the pricing literature.
I agree, Tom. The idea that high sales volumes make small price changes more economically viable is so simple yet powerful, and it's surprising that it hasn't received much attention until now.
What I found particularly impressive was the researchers' thoroughness in testing their hypothesis across various levels of analysis, from pooled data to category level and even individual product level regressions.
Absolutely. And the fact that the correlation held, even at the product level, ruling out unobserved product attributes, really strengthens their findings.
The robustness checks they conducted were also commendable, addressing potential concerns about measurement errors, alternative definitions of small price changes, and other confounding factors.
Definitely. And I appreciate how they provided a theoretical foundation for their findings by extending Barrow's menu cost model to account for sales volumes.
Yes, that theoretical support adds further credibility to their empirical results and contributes to a deeper understanding of pricing behavior in the presence of menu costs.
Overall, I found this paper to be a refreshing and insightful contribution to the literature on price stickiness and menu costs, shedding light on a long-standing puzzle in a compelling and intuitive way.
Agreed, Jen. By uncovering this important relationship between sales volumes and small price changes, the researchers have opened up new avenues for future research and potential applications in pricing strategies and policy analyses.
In conclusion, the paper Small Price Changes, Sales Volume, and Menu Cost by Syag, Sneer, and Levy presents a fascinating and robust DAN explanation for the prevalence of small price changes observed in many retail price datasets.
Their key finding is that small price changes, are significantly more likely for products with high sales volumes, a relationship that has been largely overlooked in the existing literature.
Through a series of rigorous empirical analyses and theoretical modeling, the researchers provide compelling evidence for this correlation, which holds across product categories, within categories, and even at the individual product level.
The study's use of a massive and detailed retail scanner price dataset, coupled with extensive robustness checks and a solid theoretical foundation, lends significant credibility to their findings.
By shedding light on this long-standing puzzle in pricing behavior, the researchers have not only contributed to our understanding of menu costs and price stickiness, but have also opened up new avenues for future research and potential applications in pricing strategies and policy analyses.
Indeed, this paper is a prime example of how rigorous empirical research combined with theoretical insights can illuminate complex phenomena and push the boundaries of our knowledge.
Well said, Tom. We hope our listeners found this discussion informative and engaging, and that it has sparked their curiosity about the intriguing relationship between small price changes, sales volumes, and menu costs.
Until next time, keep exploring the fascinating world of scientific discoveries with illuminating research. Here's a funny, weird, and concise commercial for a fictional company inspired by the paper Small Price Changes, Sales Volume, and Menu Cost. Jingle, nickel and dime, small change, adds up over time. Announcer, are you tired of big clunky price changes? Sick of those outdated menu costs holding you back? Well, have we got the solution for you? Introducing Nickel and Dime Pricing Solutions. We're the pioneers of small price change optimization. With our patented high-volume, low-increment pricing algorithm, we'll maximize your profits by making frequent, tiny price adjustments on your high-selling items. Customer, but won't that annoy shoppers with all those nickel and dime amounts? Nickel, nonsense. Studies show consumers don't even notice small price tweaks, especially on popular products they buy all the time. It's Menu Costnomics 101. Dime, that's right. While other pricing firms are stuck in the last century with huge disruptive price overhauls, we'll keep you ahead of the competition with surgical, stealthy price snips and clips. Two workers in green nickel and dime jumpsuits snip a few cents off a price tag with tiny scissors. From grocery chains to big box retailers, nickel and dime is revolutionizing the pricing game, one teeny adjustment at a time. Call 1-888 for a free consultation. Nickel. It's the small things that make a big difference. Dime, like our prices, and possibly your financial future. Mwah! Jingle. Nickel and dime your way to prime with Nickel and Dime Pricing Solutions. Here is a detailed podcast episode about the research paper titled Reasons Behind the Water Crisis and Its Potential Health Outcomes. Welcome to Exploring the X-Fi, the podcast that dives deep into fascinating research at the cutting edge of science. I'm Tom.
And I'm Jen. On today's episode, we'll be discussing a paper that examines a critical issue affecting billions of people around the world, the global water crisis.
The paper is titled Reasons Behind the Water Crisis and Its Potential Health Outcomes, and it's authored by Ghalib Ishraq Emran, Reedy Barma, Akram Hussain Khan, and Minmoy Roy.
This comprehensive review paper explores the complex factors driving the water crisis, as well as the serious health implications of lack of access to clean water and sanitation.
The findings are quite sobering. Nearly 1 million people die each year from diseases related to unsafe water, poor sanitation, and lack of basic hygiene, and an estimated 2.1 billion people lack access to safely managed drinking water services.
It's a crisis that disproportionately impacts developing nations, but one that no country is immune from, as water scarcity increases globally due to population growth, climate change, and mismanagement of freshwater resources.
The paper methodically examines over a dozen key reasons behind this crisis, ranging from unequal distribution and pollution of water sources to overuse, lack of infrastructure, climate change, and even corruption.
Yes, let's start by diving into some of those core drivers. One striking point is how uneven the global consumption of water is. As the authors note, the per capita water use in the US is over 50 times higher than in Mali.
It's a startling statistic that highlights the fundamental inequity baked into our freshwater distribution systems. While wealthy nations overconsume, poorer regions experience crippling scarcity.
Absolutely. And that inequality is compounded by issues like aging infrastructure and lack of investment in water management and sanitation in many parts of the world. The authors recount how in 2003, the United Nations had to establish UN Water as a dedicated platform to coordinate global efforts around water access and sanitation challenges.
It's hard to fathom, but the paper notes that over 4 billion people today still lack access to properly managed sanitation facilities. Just imagine the public health impacts of that for a moment.
Definitely. We'll dive into those consequences shortly. But first, I want to discuss one of the most visceral drivers of water scarcity mentioned, pollution. The authors provide heart-wrenching first-hand accounts, like the polluted Chilpa Lake in Dhaka, Bangladesh, that was once a community oasis, but is now thick with industrial and household waste.
It's a disturbing scene they paint of people being forced to drink and bathe in water contaminated by oil, chemicals, garbage, even raw sewage in some cases, all for lack of viable alternatives.
Precisely. Water pollution is literally poisoning humanity's most precious natural resource. The paper cites figures showing tainted water is linked to millions of cases of cholera, dysentery, and other waterborne illnesses annually.
And unfortunately, that toxic pollution is becoming harder and harder to avoid as activities like unregulated industrial dumping, overuse of fertilizers and pesticides, and fossil fuel spills continue unabated around the globe. The authors make a compelling case that if we don't get a handle on this widespread contamination of water sources, the health crisis will only worsen.
You're absolutely right, Tom. The paper goes into great detail on the potential health outcomes, which are quite staggering. Beyond the scourge of infectious waterborne diseases we discussed, lack of clean water also causes chronic illnesses and conditions.
Such as, I'm curious to learn more about some of the specific ailments and how they manifest.
Well, the paper highlights risks like fluorosis and arsenicosis from ingesting contaminated groundwater laced with those compounds. It can cause disfiguring bone and teeth deformities. Rates of malnutrition and starvation also increase when people are forced to drink unsanitary water, leading to frequent bouts of diarrhea and an inability to properly absorb nutrients.
That's just heartbreaking to think about, especially when it comes to young children whose development is drastically impaired by these conditions. The mental health toll of the water crisis is also something the authors explore, including how psychological stress and anxiety understandably increase when your basic access to safe water is perpetually threatened.
Absolutely. The human costs enumerated in the paper are staggering, which underscores how crucial it is that we find comprehensive solutions and take urgent action to address this crisis before it spirals further out of control.
You're preaching to the choir. Reading about the challenges outlined in this paper, it's clear we need a multi-pronged approach of upgrading crumbling infrastructure, investing in sustainable water management strategies like rainwater collection, and cracking down on sources of contamination. But perhaps most critically, as the authors argue, is the need to enhance global cooperation, equitable water governance, and valuing water as the precious shared resource that it is.
I couldn't agree more. The paper leaves you with a sense of crisis, but also one of supreme urgency, that we have to get this right for the billions of lives at stake. By shining a light on this critically important issue through systematically examining its drivers and consequences, the authors make a clarion call for the global community to prioritize solving the water crisis as a matter of utmost importance for public health, human rights, and ecological preservation.
You summed it up perfectly, Jen. This paper is a comprehensive exploration, but also a passionate call to action to preserve one of our most vital natural resources before we squander it completely. While the subject matter is heavy, the authors have done a laudable job of presenting the evidence and data in a compelling narrative format that drives the message home effectively.
Absolutely. It's the type of nuanced, rigorous research, complemented by powerful storytelling, that we strive to highlight on each episode of Exploring the X-Fi. I, for one, am grateful we could use our platform to broadcast these critically important findings and the urgency of the global water crisis to our listeners.
Me too, Jen. A huge thanks to Magd Ghalib Ishraq Emran, Reedy Barma, Akram Hussein Khan, Mrinmoy Roy, and all the researchers helping sound the alarm on this crisis. The struggle to ensure equitable access to clean, safe water for all people is one of the preeminent challenges facing humanity. And if this paper demonstrates anything, it's that we ignore it at our own peril.
Well said. Thanks for joining us for another thought-provoking episode of Exploring the X-Fi. We'll see you next time as we dive into more fascinating revelations from the frontiers of science and discovery.
Here's a funny, weird commercial for a fictitious company inspired by the research paper on the global water crisis. Quirky jingle plays. Are you sick and tired of drinking boring old water? Sue, 2015. Well, folks, there's a new beverage revolutionizing how we hydrate. Slurping sound effects. Announcing Uzematos, the first commercially available line of sewage-based health tonics. Man 1. No way. You're telling me this bottle contains actual sewage water? That's right, Jim. Straight from the polluted rivers and overflowing sewer grates of the world's most densely populated urban slums. But isn't that incredibly unsanitary and dangerous to consume? Shh, old ways of thinking, Marge. The amazing scientists at Uzematos have pioneered a revolutionary new viru bathing process. Using advanced bioengineering, we've enhanced every bottle with a proprietary blend of waterborne bacteria and viruses, naturally cultivated in our artisanal sewage farms. Man 2, so you're intentionally putting diseases into your beverages? I don't get it. It's the next level of probiotic health. Viru bathing infuses your gut with the same hardy microorganisms found in the Giardia-rich waters of the developing world's shanty towns, giving you powerful immunity, turbocharged metabolism, and that extra zippy. Well, you know, courtesy of good old sewage-borne dysentery. Grotesque splashing sound. I think I'm going to be sick. Don't knock it till you've tried the ooze. Uzematos, shamelessly slurping sewer sludge so you don't have to. Available now in our trenchmouth typhoid, rotting raft runoff, and horrifyingly hip hepatitis AZ variant. Announcer violently retches off mic. Jingle plays again.